Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi, folks. I'm Jalene Fenner, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today with my co-host,
Tom Majeur.
And it's that time again, Tom's favorite Strong Tower Radio Today program with the Garden Guy. Gary Heilig.
How are you doing?
We are glad. We are so glad that Gary, he is just so smart.
That's right.
And if you've not listened to us before, he is retired. He worked for Michigan State University.
As a horticulture educator. I'm sort of retired. I still do some teaching in the spring and fall.
Okay. So, yes, we are privileged to have him be part of gardening segment.
You know, the thought occurred to me, with all that knowledge, even though he's retired, it still has to be shared with the public.
That's right.
Well, if I don't use it, I'm going to lose it.
That's true. And Strong Tower Radio is part of that dissemination system.
That's right. And so we know by the calls we get and things, people do like Gary's program, The Garden Guy. Well, Tom, before we get started, why don't you have a word of prayer?
Our Father in heaven, just thank you again for the opportunity to work in your creation.
Amen.
You led us to be partners and to be stewards. Be with us as we learn to be better partners and better stewards. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, okay, so the month of August, we're going to talk about lawns. That's one of the things we're going to cover.
You know, there's two things that we talk about lawns. We talk about moles and we talk about grubs. So what are we going to do about those grubs? Do we do it ourselves or our lawn company? Is that a gimmick or is there really grubs down there?
Well, all lawns will have grubs in them.
My question, are grubs good?
Well, they're good for the moles because they like to eat them. But you can have moles and not have hardly any grubs because they eat earthworms.
Well, let me ask this question. Do all grubs look alike?
No, they don't. And it's interesting that you ask that question because the way you identify a grub is by something called the rasters on their little bottom, which is the arrangement of hairs on the bottom of the grub.
I don't think I've really looked at
pick one up and look at it either.
Well, I'll pick them up, but I'm going to start looking for the hair.
Well, it's better to have a dissecting microscope when you're doing that, but that's how we used to identify grubs.
Really?
People would bring them into the office.
So not all grubs are grubs?
No, grubs are simply the immature stage of a beetle of some sort.
Okay.
So you have Japanese beetle grubs, and this year it's going to be a better year for Japanese beetle grubs because we have moist soils. In dry years, we tend to have more grubs, which are called the European chafers, and they can do a lot of damage. So in terms of your original question, should you have your yard treated? Well, that depends. If you've had a history of grub problems, that might be one reason to have it treated. But what we normally suggest people do is go out into the yard and check. Usually they start, germinating, but they actually, they hatch out because they have eggs. And they will be in the soil around the beginning of July. And you can take a serrated knife, and cut out a square foot of your lawn in different places and dig around under the roots and see how many are there.
You lift up that soil and you see if there's any on the backside of the sod and look down into the
dirt and soil. Usually people don't notice it until they start seeing a lot of birds congregating and digging in their lawn, or raccoons or skunks. The skunks will dig holes. The raccoons will actually peel back the soil when they've done so much damage that there are not very many roots left on the grass. And so hopefully you don't wait till it's that long because you've had quite a bit of damage. But the other thing is the amount of grubs in the soil is only part of it. It's also how you maintain your lawn. So if you are fertilizing and watering your lawn and the lawn is lush and growing well, it can handle about 12 to 15 grubs per square foot. Whereas if you did nothing, you'll start having damages, say, 8 or 9 grubs per square foot. So that makes a difference also. So I would prefer to check because, you know, lawn care companies are in business to make money, and they make money by making applications. So sometimes they may make an application which is insurance for people. They don't have to worry about a grub problem if they get this treatment. But if you want to know whether you really need it, you should go out and check in different places and see if there's any grub activity.
So you said 12 to 15 or 8 plus. I don't know if I've ever seen that many grubs in, or I'm just not looking closely.
Well, unless you're digging in the soil, you're not going to find them. They're not on the surface. They're just below the roots, feeding on the roots.
So, yeah, so what do they do to the lawn? I guess that's...
Well, they can get to the point where they feed so much on the roots that the lawn dies, that okay. section where they're feeding. And they'll just keep moving out into the healthy grass, so they can kill a very large area if there are a lot of grubs there.
And that can happen in one season.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then that leads us to, okay, so that's happened. I need to start a new lawn.
What do we do? Well, that or what do you do about when you have them?
Yeah.
And there are products that you can use. For instance, if the grubs are primarily Japanese beetles, there are products like Grub Attack, which is a bacillus, which is Bacillus popillae, and it will kill them. And once you put it there, it will last for a while. We used to think that the bacteria wouldn't survive our winters, but it does. Now, if it's the other grub, the European chafer, there's a product called Merit that will kill them. The bacteria does not have much of an effect on the Japanese beetle grubs, I mean the European chafer grubs. So you have to use something like Merit, which is imidacloprid, and it has to be put down at the time that they're starting to hatch out. Yeah, that's a chemical, yeah. It's a very common chemical. It's used for ornamental trees. It can be even used on vegetables. So anyway, if you put that down before they're getting started, you're okay. There are some things that don't work. Like, for instance, some of these products for killing soil insects like Cyfluthrin will not affect the grubs.
Now, in our neighborhood, when I lived in the city, I remember one or two lawns out of 100 house subdivision would get, the lawn would just turn, in the summer, would turn gray, and it seemed like there was no green in it at all. Would that be grubs, or is there something else that was eating at the lawn?
Usually, if a lawn turns uniformly a certain color, it's not grubs, because grubs start in certain areas, and then they move from those areas, and so you see more of a patchwork of feeding.
Okay.
And if you have, say, tall fescue in the lawn, they won't feed on that, so you'll see little tufts of tall fescue left in the lawn. That's more likely to be something else, and that's when I start asking questions. Now, we have in the north what we call cool season grasses, and if they're not watered and it gets warm or hot, they go dormant. Not necessarily dead, but they go dormant, and that is more uniform. The other thing I want to mention, too, when you're trying to control grubs, if you miss the summer application and you're getting into fall, things like Merit don't work anymore, and you have to switch over to a granular 7 or another material called Dilox. Or if you don't get it done then, in the spring, as soon as the grass starts growing, if there's still mole activity or grub activity, then you would use that 7 granular or the Dilox to kill them, because Merit won't work at that point.
So we have to do some lawn renovation then. Where we want to establish a lawn or something, what is the best way? I mean, you see people bring in sod. And that's a it's done. It's you got a beautiful lawn, but you got to maintain it to keep it. So,
yeah.
What is the best? Seeding it, sodding it.
Well, sodding does give you a quick lawn. So, if you're somebody that's trying to sell a house and you need a lawn fast, then sodding is the way to go. One thing I tell people to watch out about sodding is if you're in a new subdivision.
Yep.
And many times they sell the topsoil, and in our area, they put down a sod on a clay soil, and I guarantee you, you're going to have disease problems within about a year or two.
Because you need that topsoil.
You need that topsoil. So if you're putting down sod, things have to be prepared appropriately. Run a soil test. Make sure that you have your slope away from the house. You have topsoil there, and once your topsoil has been sold, it becomes expensive to replace it, because you have to put on a minimum of 3 inches. We prefer about 6. Mm. And depending on how large your yard is, that can set you back.
Wow.
So if you are going to buy a house in a subdivision, you want to be sure your topsoil is there. Otherwise, you're going to have problems with your plants.
And you just brought back a memory. My parents bought a house in the 1967. the topsoil had been removed, and the rains came, and we had ruts, and you know, so my parents bought sod, and I know we didn't put down topsoil, and so I understand where the problem is. The backyard, we seeded, but we didn't add topsoil either. So we had two problems, the sodded problems and the seeded problems. But the seeded one actually lived and did better. The sod...
It usually does, yeah.
Became more like a mat, mm-hmm. a dead mat or sparse mat.
Yeah, I had one lady call me once that some guy had extra sod. And he put it down in the yard and did no preparation. And every time she watered, the sod would float. So she had to start all over again.
Yeah.
But that's just one way. But seeding a lawn is much less expensive. It does take a little bit longer for it to get established. But you have options, more options. With a sod, you're usually getting a Kentucky bluegrass blend, which is all Kentucky bluegrasses, but they're different varieties of it. With seeding, it's usually a mixture, which will be Kentucky bluegrasses, fescue, and perennial rye. Then there is another way of seeding, which is called hydro seeding. And you see that along in big park work or long roads. It's where they spray a mixture of seed, fertilizer, a binder, which is like a newspaper-like material. And they just spray it on, and the binder holds it in place. And then, of course, it comes in. So normally people don't do that. You can rent machines for hydro seeding from, you know, places like Lowe's and Menards, places like that. If you have a large area, it is faster, but you still have to prepare the soil. You need to run a soil test, put down the fertilizer that's needed, till it up. If there are any perennial weeds there, those have to be taken care of. And a lot of people don't like to use things like Roundup, but that's the fastest way to deal with it. You can cover it over, but it takes about a month or more to kill the weeds out in those areas. And then the other thing you have to think about is, do I have shade, sun? And then you have to get the proper mix. And you can also change the mixture. For instance, you get what you pay for when you buy grass seed. If you buy the poor quality, you usually will have more weed seeds in it. It might have a lower germination percentage. And it may have what's called... common varieties.
And you have annuals, too, that stuff just sprouts up.
Well, there'll be some annual bluegrass in there, but that's usually, it's not supposed to be there. There's a certain percentage that they allow. But when you get the better seed, it's improved varieties, which means that it may not need as much water. It doesn't need as much fertilizer to look good. And they're more disease resistant. So you get what you pay for when you buy seed.
So you're talking about, you know, I mean, I've heard a lot of the Kentucky bluegrass. But there's other, like, brand names or other varieties.
Yeah. Actually, we're talking about species. Because a variety, if you were talking about apples, the apple would be the species. The variety would be Golden Delicious, Red Delicious, Jonathan, that type of thing. So what you can get is, in a mixture, is multiple Kentucky bluegrass varieties. You may have multiple varieties of fescues, which are chewing or red fescues. And then the last is perennial rye, which most people couldn't tell the difference. But perennial rye is what we call the nurse grass. That's the first one that comes up, usually within about a week, whereas Kentucky bluegrass can take up to a month to germinate.
So that's why you want to be taking care of. If it's dry, you definitely want to be watering.
Oh, you have to water every day.
Okay.
And you don't have to water long, only about 15 minutes or so. And that's where a timer can be helpful if you're away at work. And you also put down straw on top of the seed to hold moisture in. And you use about 1 bale per 1,000 square feet. And if you put it at that rate, you won't have to take it up.
You know, when we were in Wisconsin, the maintenance man at a nursing home, he just had a green thumb. When it came to planting grass, I've never seen anybody make it grow so fast or so well. In a couple of weeks, you could tell he had planted seeds and there was something there.
Mm-hmm. He knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, timing is everything. The fertility of the soil can make a difference.
Now, what about
quality of the seed?
Sunny versus shade. Does that make a difference in the kind of seed?
Well, the mixtures usually have higher percentages of the fescues and a lower percentage of Kentucky bluegrass, and they have Kentucky bluegrass varieties in there that are more shade tolerant.
Now, I keep hearing you say fescues. So what is that?
Fescue is a type of grass that usually has a much thinner blade. And as it gets long, it tends to lay down. It's very soft. It's much more shade tolerant, drought tolerant. It doesn't have very many disease problems. Whereas Kentucky bluegrass is a much wider blade, and perennial rye is also a wider blade.
That's why it's good to have this as a mixture, a variety
right,
in it.
Yeah. And the reason for the mixture, too, is if you get a disease, it won't wipe out your lawn like would be if you had just a monoculture of one species.
Another question they have, what if you have just a localized area? For instance, you had to, if you're in the country, you had to dig up your septic tank or you had to move something. We put in a previous house, we put in a egress window and we had to mound up the soil around the egress culvert or mm-hmm. material around that. And I used for the first time something I rolled out and it had seeds already in it. And
a seed mat.
And some of that worked pretty good. I was surprised. It's expensive.
Yeah, you do pay a higher price for that convenience. But for people that don't want to fuss with it, that's the way to go.
And especially it was on a grade, so mm-hmm. you had erosion possibilities.
That's right. It also helps to keep the soil in place.
Now, so when you're getting, you know, you're getting ready to put your lawn in, whether, you know, it's a new lawn or you've had diseases and you need to like cultivate, I mean, get rid of some of this bad stuff that's in mm-hmm. the lawn, right?
Yeah. Well, the best time to get that lawn started is between mid-August and mid-September because that's, you don't have as many weed seeds germinating then as you do in the spring. As I mentioned before, you do need to clear out the area. Otherwise, you're going to have weed problems.
They're going to come back, right?
That's right. But the thing I tell people is establish the grass first. You can always deal with the weeds. But if you don't establish the grass, that's all you're going to deal with is weeds because mm-hmm. you have a big open area, and that's what weeds like. And then, of course, the seeding rate makes a difference. We usually suggest 3 to 4 pounds of seed per 1,000 square feet. It can get a little higher if you want. And when you buy a mixture, if you want more Kentucky bluegrass in that mixture, you can buy just Kentucky mm-hmm. bluegrass, some of the newer varieties, and mix mm-hmm. it in with it. After you put down the fertilizer and everything, and you put down your grass seed, you put down your straw and your water, you water it, you do not mow it right away, especially if you don't have a sharp blade because you'll rip the plants out. But you want to wait till it gets really established before you start mowing it.
So you want it to grow maybe a little longer than you normally would want.
Right, yeah. And of course, have the mowing height as high as possible at first, but you can lower it down and that grass will spread out a little bit more. Now, another way you can get a lawn renovated, in other words, improve an existing lawn, or even if it's a new lawn, you can use something called an overseeder. There's a lot of different names for it. You can rent those also. And what those do is you put the seed in a little hopper in the back. It looks about the size of a rototiller. And it has these little blades in the front, and it's not self-propelled, so it's a bit of a job, especially if the soil is soft. So I suggest you not do a lot of tilling if you're going to use one of these. And you can just sow right into the soil, and it puts the seed in contact with the soil. And you can go north and south, and if you still have seed, you can go east and west. And that seed will come up pretty quickly, and your lawn will get established. You can do this with an existing lawn. If the lawn's not looking too good, you can overseed it, and it'll come in and really improve. And then in the fall, after it's established, after about a couple of months, then you can take care of the weed problem in the fall, and you'll have a really nice lawn in the spring.
You know, Jelaine, I learn something new every day. This overseeding, that's going to put that in the inventory.
Yeah. So this is a good time to overseed is a lawn.
You can overseed right now because the seed will be in contact with the soil. And, of course, you still will have to water that seed.
Right.
And it'll really improve the quality of your lawn.
Okay. Well, folks, we have got to take a quick break. But stay tuned because we're going to come back and talk about harvesting. Do you want an easy way to support Strong Tar Radio and it won't cost you anything? If you shop Amazon, you can set up your account to have them donate to us. Just go to smile.amazon.com and pick Strong Tower Radio as your charitable organization, and they will donate 0.5% of the eligible purchase to us. That's smile.amazon.com. And you can do more to support Strong Tower Radio by going to strongtowerradio.org and hit the donate button and become a monthly covenant partner. Remember, every little bit helps. We should do all in our power to spread the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, 6 through 12. Hi, folks. Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio Today. I'm your host, Jelaine Fenner, and my co-host,
Tom Majeure.
And we are in the middle of our garden guy for the month of August with Gary Heilig.
Hello.
We are so glad that Gary is always here. We just talked the whole first segment about lawns.
So everybody can relate to lawns.
Yes, because everybody usually has a lawn.
Unless you're in an apartment complex.
Yeah. And if... if you're like me, my lawn needs help. So
that's right.
We're going to see. But now we want to move on to, it's the month of August, and we're starting to harvest some fruits and vegetables.
That's right.
Hopefully.
That's right. We should be. Well, so what should we be doing?
Well, I'll tell you what. This is where the fun starts getting. I mean, you put in all this work, and now you go out and to finding that, whatever it is, if it's a vegetable, a tomato, and this is when the fun begins.
So it's the fruits of your labor.
That's right.
Yeah.
Ha-ha.
Yeah, that's true.
Very good, Jelaine.
Well, one of the things I think about is zucchini, which is when the zucchini starts coming in, people start locking their doors. But most of the time, people will allow zucchini to get way too large. Mm-hmm. And the ideal zucchini is about 8 inches long. And it's a better quality fruit at that point. And if you continue to take the zucchini off, then it'll continue to produce. If you don't want it to produce anymore, just leave one on and let it get huge, because that sends chemical signals to the plant. It's time to die because I produced the seeds. And also, sweet corn starts coming in at that time. And a lot of people don't know how to tell when sweet corn is ready. A couple of things. The silk should be dry at the top. And you can run your finger along the ear, and you should feel bumps. And then pull the shuck down a little bit, the outer leaves, and put your fingernail into one of the kernels, and it should be milky. If it's getting solid, then you've waited too long to pick corn.
Dense.
That's when the Eastern Europeans like it.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah. They don't like the sweet corn when it's really milky. We have some Eastern Europeans that said, oh, no, it's not ready yet. But
okay, so they like it crunchy.
Yeah, they like it a little bit more. And I like it all the way, but it gets to the point where it's almost sticky in your mouth. And that's just way too long. Of course, tomatoes are fairly easy to determine when they're ready. It's when they're red. And you can pick a tomato before that. For instance, when they're a little bit more than green, you can pick them and they'll ripen off the vine, but they won't be as sweet as they normally would be. They don't develop the sugars.
So it's best to keep them till they're red on the vine to be sweeter.
If you want the highest level of sugars and nutrients,
That's the reward of the gardening is that vine ripened. I mean, if you can take it off the vine and take it and slice it and say your prayer, and then
it's so different than what we get out of
the grocery stores. That's when the tomato tastes the best, right off of the vine.
They have full flavor then, because when they harvest tomatoes during the winter months, they're green, and they use a artificial plant hormone, which is ethylene, to finish the ripening process, but it doesn't do anything for the development of flavor. And they have gotten a little bit better in the stores now because they are getting vine-ripened tomatoes from greenhouse-grown tomatoes here in Michigan. And those do taste better, but they still aren't the same.
No, there's a difference, that's right, between greenhouse tomatoes on the vine or the tomato in your garden on the vine.
There is a taste difference. Definitely different.
So let me ask you this, though, since you take it off when it's kind of green, it's not totally ripe. Maybe because, there's going to be a frost in August. You never know. There could be. So where do you put it to let it ripen?
It doesn't really matter. Okay. People think that you need to put it in the light. That's not true. You can wrap them up in newspaper and put them in the basement. They'll still turn red. So you can let them just sit in a bowl on the countertop and they'll ripen just fine. Another thing about tomatoes is that you can eat them green.
What?
People
there, there's
eat
a movie. Green tomatoes.
Green fried tomatoes.
Yes.
Not everybody likes them, but it's something you can do. Now, the reason why I would pick something when it's green is usually we're getting close to a real frost, and I want to get everything off of the plant before there's damage. So then we just haul everything into the house or the garage and let them ripen naturally.
But, yeah, so green tomatoes taste different than a red ripened tomato.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are some cultivars of tomatoes that when they're ripe, they're green.
Oh, okay.
Because tomatoes come in red, pink, orange, yellow, kind of a brownish purple.
Yeah, there's
different
varieties.
And then, of course, there are some that are green. And if you want to grow some of these, most likely you have to buy the seeds yourself. And there, I think I mentioned this before, there is a catalog called Totally Tomatoes, which has many of these varieties if you want to try different things.
You make it exotic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I like color and I like variety. And maybe I'll go after that next year.
Well, God made, that's why there, he made different colors, because those different colors can be good for us.
Well, and they represent different nutrients, because you have more vitamin A in yellow vegetables, for instance. Also, collards, you can harvest at any time. And if you want more tender collards, you want the smaller leaves. When you allow collards to grow during the whole season, their much larger leaves are a little bit tougher, but once you get a light frost, the flavor of any of the brassicas will improve.
Now, there's different varieties of collards.
Oh, yeah. There's Georgian collards. There's all varieties of the different brassicas like kale, and all of those will develop a little better flavor if they have a light frost. Now, if it's a really hard frost, then the flavor goes downhill very fast.
So I got a question. I learned that you can take turnip greens and you can take all kinds of greens. Can you eat everything that's green in the garden?
Well, I certainly wouldn't eat eggplant leaves or tomato leaves.
That's right.
So actually, tomato leaves do have some things in them that you might not agree with your tummy. So, but for instance, broccoli leaves, which we normally don't eat, they are edible. Turnip greens, most people will think of eating the turnips, but the greens are many times mixed with mustard greens, and I grew up on that. I just love greens.
And beet greens.
Yeah, beet greens are very good for you, very nutritious. So with the beet, you don't have to waste anything. And a lot of people don't like beets, but they're really good for you. So.
And just along that line, we're throwing a lot of these things, so like the tops of these, we're throwing them away when they're actually nutrition that's going into the compost pile. At least it's going in the compost
pile. Well, in that case, you're recycling the nutrients. It'll come back somewhere else.
Yeah. So it's not, they're not being wasted, right?
No. You know, it's worm food. It's, but, I mean, if it's good and a lot of people eat beet greens and they love them, I would at least try it. Okay. So,
and the nutrients are plentiful.
Yeah, and there is a website called nutritiondata.com, and you can look up the nutrition of just about any vegetable, and they might even have beet greens in there, and they'll tell you exactly what's in there, not only the vitamins, but all the minerals and the omega-3s, omega-6s, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
So let me ask about eggplants. How do you know when the eggplant is ripe?
Well, when an eggplant is ripe, it is based on the variety, because if you're growing an Asian variety, they tend to be smaller and longer, but they should be shiny and about, normally about 6 to 8 inches is the best. Some varieties like Black Beauty, they'll get fairly large, like what you see in the store, and they're still edible, but you have more of a seed cavity when you let them to get really large. So if you want the best quality, then go for the smaller eggplants. They can be harvested at any point of their development.
So they're like zucchini, kind of.
They can be harvested small. They can be harvested larger.
What about, let's go across the garden and harvesting. Let's talk about carrots. When do you harvest carrots?
Well, carrots, they can grow on into the fall, and they can be stored in the ground through the winter if you protect them. But a carrot can be eaten when it gets as large as you want it. Now, again, they will get sweeter when there's been a lighter frost, because most of those sugars, in fact, just about all of them, are stored in the taproot. So a carrot will get sweeter as you get further into the season.
No.
But you can harvest it at any time.
Now, we have other greens, we have lettuces and such. Usually, younger is better.
Yeah, if you leave lettuce in the garden too long, it tends to get bitter, especially during the heat of the summer. But what I like to do, I grow them in a small raised bed behind the garage, and we harvest leaves off of the lettuce and just let it keep growing. Now, sometimes it will bolt, depending on what kind of lettuce it is, and bolting is where it produces a seed head. But as long as the quality of the lettuce is good, you can just keep on harvesting. And you can do the same thing with various greens, too. Instead of pulling them all up, you can just shear them off, like, say, spinach or the greens, and you fertilize them after that and keep watering them. They'll grow back.
And you mentioned bolting. Broccoli, when it bolts, can you salvage a broccoli plant after it's bolted? Is there any harvestable tasty things? It seemed to be a problematic.
It's not really bolting in the sense of the word, because what broccoli, the part that we actually eat is the developing flower bud. So what you're seeing is that the flowers are just opening, and you get that little four-petaled flower, yellow flower, and then it will produce the seeds. So it's not really bolting. It's doing what it's supposed to do.
But get past that point, can you still harvest it?
Well, you could cut off the top, and you'll get axillary buds. It'll come up, and those
can be harvested. So we need to what is bolting? Because some people that are not gardeners, beginning gardeners, might not know what bolting is.
Well, bolting is where the plant goes from vegetative stage, like lettuce growing all leaves, to a stage where it produces a seed head. And usually the plant's not really that tasty after that happens. So spinach is what we call a biennial vegetable. If you allow the spinach to stay in the garden, the next season it will produce a seed head. It'll start with leaves and then it'll produce a seed head.
So when you're talking about broccoli, you get where broccoli's growing, and if you leave it too long, yes, all of a sudden you're getting yellow in that.
Flowers. But that's not technically bolting, because that's what you want is a developing flower bud to eat. It's just that when it flowers, you've waited too long to pick it.
Okay.
You mentioned about the biennial. Go back to that. And there's some things I can leave in my garden two seasons.
Well, for instance, onions are biennial vegetables, carrots are biennial vegetables, lettuce, spinach. A number of things are biennial, which means that they will grow vegetatively the first year, and then they will produce a seed head the second year. And that's where the seed comes from when you go to the garden center. They allow these things to stay in the ground and produce a seed head the following year.
And are they edible in the second year?
It depends on what it is. For instance, spinach, before it produces a seed head, it produces leaves. So those leaves are edible at that time. Some other things like lettuce, it's not going to taste that great when it's bolting.
So that's how we can continue to have vegetables producing. We cut off,
don't rip them out.
Yes.
Cut them off. Some of them you can do that, and they'll come back as long as you continue to fertilize and water. They'll come back.
So let me ask you about carrots. You brought that up. They can continue to grow, and they can get as big as you want.
They have their limitations genetically.
Well, yeah, okay. But I've always heard that the smaller they are, the sweeter they are. But you said something about another frost.
No, because the sweetness comes from the carbohydrates, and the longer the carrot's in the ground, the more carbohydrates it could develop. Now, there is variety in carrots. Some will get sweeter sooner than others.
Okay.
It's just like people, some people can run farther than others. It's a matter of genetics.
I see. Okay. All right, so now let's talk about harvesting, the peaches and apples, and because usually in August, we're harvesting the fruit.
Yeah, usually about the second, third week of August, we start harvesting peaches, depending on where you are in the state, at least in our area down in mid-Michigan. And what I do to determine whether or not my peaches are ready, the first thing I want to know is what is the calendar date where they're expected to be ready. And usually they won't vary more than a few days either way. Second thing I will do is I'll grab the peach from the bottom and lift up and twist. And if it comes off easily, that's a pretty good indication that it's ready. Another thing I will do is I will squeeze the peach slightly, because if it's ready to eat, it's going to give a little bit. And also, it should smell like a peach. Mm. So when people go to stores and they get these peaches from various countries, and you smell it and you smell no peach smell at all,
leave it there.
It's not going to be good. I guarantee that.
Now, is that true for any most of the fruits, if you pick them up? I mean, because like strawberries, you can smell sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
They smell really good, and other times there's no smell much to them.
Yeah, and what do you notice about the taste when they don't have much of a smell?
Yeah.
They just don't, they're not sweet, and they're just not all that desirable.
So
the smell does make a difference in a lot of different things. No, not lettuce or spinach, but
right,
you know.
Right, but you know, the fruits more. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I know with peaches, I'm not a big peach eater, my husband is, but I always want to squeeze it a little bit. And when it's hard as a rock, I'm like, if I buy it, it's going to have to sit around for a while.
Well, what I used to do is when I was checking my peaches, if it gave just a little bit, I mean, and it's not a very hard squeeze either, I would take it off and take it in the house, and it would soften up within a day or two, and those peaches are ready to pick. Now, if I'm going to process peaches, I don't want all of my peaches totally ripe, because if you're going to process peaches, some firmer ones will have a higher level of pectin. Mm-hmm. And if you're making jams and jellies and things, you would like to have higher levels of pectin. So I'd mix different things together. If you wait till it's completely ripe so that you squeeze it and it really gives, that peach has to be consumed right away.
And but it's real soft. You need to eat it right away.
You have to eat it right away, and it should be refrigerated right away. Now, there's some apples that come in around August. And the early apples aren't the best quality apples, but again, the thing that you want to do is smell them. They don't give so much, but you may have to taste a couple of them to see what the starch level is in the apple. And pears, we have pears that are ready in August. Do not allow them to ripen on the tree. Otherwise, they develop stone cells. And when you bite into it, it's fairly gritty. And pears don't give off that odor. By the time they give off a pear odor, it's probably overripe.
They're too ripe.
And they ripen from the inside. So they can be soft on the inside and rotten on the inside. So we don't allow them to ripen on the tree if you want the best quality.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about tomatoes. The blossom end rot, what is that?
Blossom end rot is actually a calcium deficiency. And when you have really wet soils, and then they get dry, and then they get wet, and they get dry, that dry-wet cycle tends to cause problems for the plant, and calcium doesn't move very well. So what happens is it draws the calcium out of the developing fruit, and the bottom of it will rot. And many times you won't notice it until you look at the bottom, and it's kind of black and flat. So the best way to avoid blossom end rot is to mulch, so that even during the dry times, the water levels don't go down as quickly, or water on a regular basis, especially when you're getting close to harvest. And you tend to have more blossom end rot when you prune tomato plants.
So when should you prune the tomato plant?
You don't really have to prune tomato plants. Some people like to take out the wood that's not going to produce fruit, that's in the axles of the of the branch.
That's between the branches and the main stem.
I don't do that. It's extra work. And I've not seen much of a difference in terms of production. So if you like doing that, feel free to do it. But
more work, huh, Tom?
That's right. I'm going to reduce my maintenance here.
Yeah.
Okay, well, folks, it's time for us to take a quick break. But stay tuned, because we're going to come back. One thing we're going to talk about is composting, because you need to start thinking about that.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org. And there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio. where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jalene Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with my co-host,
Tom Mazur.
And we have the garden guy, Gary Heilig.
Yes, indeed.
And this is our last segment, and we were in the month of August, and we've been covering a lot of things. Now, Gary, let's ask about pruning. Is there things you should be pruning in August?
Well, if you have fruit trees like apples or pears that have fire blight, that needs to be pruned out.
And what is fire blight?
Fire blight is a bacterial disease.
Okay.
And it looks just like somebody burnt the branch.
Okay.
It turns brown and it just keeps moving down. If it gets into the main trunk, it'll kill the tree.
Serious stuff.
Yeah. Now, if you have trees that are growing too vigorously, or if you didn't thin out enough and the tree's too thick, you can do some pruning in August to get more light inside the tree. But also, if you have an overly vigorous tree because you fertilize too much and you have a lot of rain, then by pruning in August, you're removing tissue, which will then slow down the growth of the tree the following season.
Okay.
All right. Now, okay, so we're in August. Is there any late season greens we can plant?
Yeah, you can still get spinach in and certain greens. They may not get their full size, but if you have an open space in the garden, one way to increase your production is always think about what you can produce. So even something like cilantro, which is used in making salsas and in Mexican food, that's pretty fast growing, so you can put that in. And but primarily it's the lettuce, and it won't make a head if you're planting head lettuce, but it will produce enough leaves where you can use it.
Yeah.
I have a question. What would cause an open space in a garden?
You've harvested something.
Okay. And what would those be? I need a little memory jog.
For instance, if somebody was finished with their cabbage and they just pulled all that stuff out, there are certain cabbages that are fairly small head and they don't take a long time to produce. So you might have an opening in August.
Good.
And various greens.
Mm-hmm. How do we deal with Japanese beetles?
Yeah, they are a real problem. Japanese beetle, and I expect it could be more of a problem this year unless they drowned in the soil.
because it's been a wet summer, spring, yeah. And summer.
So those
we can hope.
Do those beetles come out of your garden, or do they come out of your lawn?
They come out of the lawn, and a lot of times people think, well, if I just put down something to control the grubs, it's okay. But they can travel quite a distance, so unless you treated a whole area, it's not going to work. But they love grapes, and they will feed on roses. They'll get on your apple trees or a wide variety of plants they will feed on.
So I have an apple tree adjacent to my garden. Have I got a bad environment?
Well, I mean, they feed on about 500 different plants. So
okay.
That's not going to make much of a difference. But there are a couple of pesticides that you can use. This is where 7 can be useful because it's really toxic to them, just as long as something's not in bloom. And I also suggest people use neem. Neem is a extract from the neem tree, which is grown in India. And you can also mix in with that if you're organic, a pyrethrum rotenone mix, although all mixtures of pyrethrum rotenone aren't cleared for organic use. The neem has the ability to repel Japanese beetles for up to 2 days if you get it on early enough. If you're putting it on at the time when they're just ravaging your plant, it's not going to work. But if you're putting it on at the time when they're just coming out, you have a good chance. Now, some people also like to use traps, and those traps do work, but you can't put them near your plants. It has to be at least 50 to 100 feet away from the plants you're trying to protect. And that's the big mistake most people make. It is kind of expensive because if you want to really make a difference, you really need to use a lot of traps. Now, there is a parasite. And if you go to an area where they've introduced this parasite, which there are various places around Michigan, then you can introduce that parasite to your soil, and it takes a number of years, but once you do that, your Japanese beetle levels will drop quite a bit.
Very good. Let's move on to composting. What are the ABC basics of composting.
And so you need to start thinking about composting here in August?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you have a lot of extra grass. And then, of course, people are always pulling weeds out of their garden. They may have kitchen materials they want to throw out when they're trimming lettuce or whatever the case may be. And then, of course, when you harvest stuff, there's times that you're going to start tearing things out of the garden. And a lot of people just throw these things away, but that's organic matter that would improve your soil. So what you want to do is get the right high carbon to high nitrogen mix together. For instance, high carbon material would be things like sawdust, leaves, even cardboard and paper products if you want to chop them up. But high nitrogen products would be grass clippings, fresh vegetable matter. And what you want to do is have about twice as much of the high carbon material as you do high nitrogen material. If you have too much nitrogen in a compost pile, you'll start to get the production of ammonia. And there are different ways of composting. For instance, we do pit composting where we just dig pits in our garden and put all that stuff in there and cover it up and then let the worms take care of it.
Now, when you say pit composting, how deep, how big, or how big?
It depends on how much material you have to bury. But the hole should be at least 16 inches deep if you're taking materials from inside the house. And you can compost things like spaghetti. Normally you don't want to put meats in a compost pile because of the smell, and you don't want it on the surface. But if you're burying it, it's okay to use it that way.
So if you're going to have this pit, you could, if you had meat, you'd put it in the bottom.
Yeah, you put it in the bottom at least 16 to 18 inches deep. And when you're pouring stuff in there, you don't want to be sloppy and get the remnants all around the edges, because then that will attract things right. like raccoons, skunks, dogs, and
so
various
a lot
other
of food
things.
Scraps. Mm-hmm. Food scraps can be good for composting, right? Food mm-hmm. scraps.
Food scraps can be, yeah. I try to save just about everything from the kitchen, so when we have a watermelon or a muskmelon or apples or whatever, we're collecting all of that, and then we take it outside and put it in the compost pile.
You know, my husband, like, yeah, we have the rinds of all that stuff, throws it over the edge, but that's not where our garden is. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, you should have a designated place yeah. for your compost pile, and preferably, if you can have it right in the garden, you won't
yeah,
have to haul it.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. It's
you won't
place.
Have to haul it anywhere, but I have yeah. one of those turning units for kitchen waste, so we go right out the back door and put it in there. Mm-hmm. We also have an area for large amounts of stuff like leaves and things, and then we do pit composting in the garden too. So we try not to allow anything to leave our property if we can.
So the food scraps you have, and can you mix that with leaves and grass?
You can, but you want to put that down first and put the leaves and grass okay. on top of it so you're not attracting rodents. If you're in a city, they might even have ordinances against putting food materials in compost piles because people get sloppy and they attract rats. And
well, that's what you were saying. Yeah, if you make a pit, you put it at the bottom.
Yeah, that you don't have to worry about because it's deep enough to where you're not going to attract anything.
Can you compost indoors?
Yes, you can. It's something called worm composting, and I have three bins down the basement. And I probably have a cubic yard of material right now that's been composting since last year. And I will use that to work into various containers that I have. I'm going to plant some grapes. I'll use it for that. And so there are lots of things you can use it for. And that's another option when it gets real cold. The material goes downstairs. You have to be careful about high water containing materials because unless there's some way to get the extra water out, it can get like a mud, so, which will kill your worms.
Okay, so you have these bins in your basement. Like, how mm-hmm. big are they?
They're very large plastic bins, you know, the ones that are about 3.5 feet by 2 feet, and they're about almost 2 feet high. I have three of them down there.
Okay, so that's where you're putting. So if you have three of them, are they three different kinds of composting?
No, it's all the kitchen scraps. It's just that being vegetarians, we have more food scraps from vegetables and fruits than most people would. And so I need more bins. I actually need four. But what I do is I will take that and work it into the garden. I will save just a few of the worms and start the whole thing over. And the other worms that have been working so hard for me, they get their freedom.
So, okay, now where do you get your worms?
You can actually buy them, but the best way is to hook up with a master gardener that already is doing that, and many times they're free to get, they're very happy to give you worms. They're red worms. They're also called red wigglers, and they reproduce very well inside a container, whereas the Canadian nightcrawlers do not, and they'll compost the material down to like a topsoil material. And another thing I do is I take all the soil that are in containers, and I take it down to the basement, and I use that as the bedding as opposed to shredded newspapers. Oh. And so basically I'm re-enriching that soil, and then I put it back in the pots.
I have a question along that. I just imagine taking all this compost down the basement and the odors kind of coming up. How do you deal with odor control?
If you do it right, there is no odor. It smells like soil.
So what do you mean do it right? What do you got to do?
For instance, if you get a lot of water in it, and it becomes what we call anaerobic, then it's a different group of bacteria, and then it starts to smell like a septic tank.
So you don't want it a lot of moisture, I mean, like you said, mud or the water.
Yeah, what you normally would do in those plastic containers is you'll put little vents in there and put some screen over it, very fine screen, so nothing can get in, and that helps things to dry out. Also, not overloading it. That's why it's better to have multiple bins if you have too much material, or just put some in there for the worms and then take the rest of it outside into other types of composting areas. And if you are not getting it too wet, not feeding it too much, then it just smells like soil.
So you're making your own topsoil. That's interesting.
Yeah. And what I do is I'll put the material down and then I'll put a layer of the topsoil over it so it's completely covered. So you don't have odors that way. And of course, you're not putting meat and those types of things in there. That's where you,
yeah,
meats and oils, and that's when you start getting smells.
Yeah. Okay. You know, you had on our list that, because he comes in, he always gives us a good list of things we're going to talk about or questions we might ask him. And you had something about hardy bananas. And we don't grow bananas in Michigan, do we?
Well, you can grow them indoors. It will actually produce bananas, but this is an ornamental banana. And they can get quite large, and they look very decorative in a flower bed. And so I decided to try a couple of them this year, and I put them up against the house where they would, you know, get a little heat coming off of the house. And, of course, we had that solar vortex that wiped them out.
Aww.
So I replanted this year, and I'm going to try something a little different. I'm going to really mound up a lot of material over them to see if I can protect them. But they're supposed to be hardy to zone 5, but not last year they weren't. But they, even if you grow them as annuals, they're not that expensive, and you can buy them as seeds. The ornamental bananas can look quite nice in an annual or a perennial garden.
So how big are the bananas?
Last year's got about 6 feet tall.
Wow. Okay.
And the leaves got about a foot wide and about 4 or 5 feet long.
Because banana leaves are quite big.
Oh, yeah.
So then the banana, so you let it stay on till it turns?
Well, these are ornamental bananas, which means they're not producing edible fruit.
Oh.
There are some that will produce edible fruit, but it usually takes a couple of years. And those have to be grown inside. They can be set outside during the summer, but during the winter months, they'd have to be under plant lights.
Well, and how tall do those get? If you're gonna, you want to have edible bananas?
No, they have very short ones that they'll stay around 6 feet. Okay. Now, you can go to some companies and you can buy the same bananas that are being grown in the tropics, like in Costa Rica, and some of those get to be 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
Well, you better have some space for something that big.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
Like a greenhouse.
But now, so what you were talking, the hardy bananas, it's more, it's not for the edible fruit.
Right, it's a hardy banana.
That's
plant.
Saying, ornamental.
Yeah, but they just call them hardy bananas.
It's just something exotic in your garden.
Yeah,
right?
Something very different. You'll notice that the longer people are gardeners, many times they want to do more exotic things and things that are a challenge.
Okay, well, let's talk about your annuals. And I'm thinking, well, one thing, flowers. You know, annuals. I mean, usually in your garden. You're not, because we talked earlier about leaving something so then the next year it comes up. But usually almost everything in your garden is, well, not everything. I shouldn't say that because you got strawberries and, you know, some kind of fruits. But your annuals, then when they die, well, So are we using
An annual simply means that it goes through its complete life cycle in one season from seed to seed.
Okay.
Whereas we talked about biennials, that's vegetative the first year, seed the second year, and a perennial, the top dies, but the roots will survive. And the reason I put this on here is we have a lot of annual flowers that will look better longer if you go through a process called deadheading.
What's that?
A deadheading is where when a flower dies, you simply take it off. Because again, when these plants are finished flowering and they produce seeds, those seeds are telling that plant it's time to start to slow down its growth and get ready for death. So when you take off those, it doesn't get that chemical message and they'll keep producing flowers. Zinnias is an example, or marigolds are two examples of plants that need to be deadheaded.
Salvia also.
Yeah, some things can be cut back a little bit, but also there are newer varieties now that do not require deadheading. Some of the All-America selections, what happens is they grow and they cover the old flowers and you don't have to go in there and deadhead them. So if you're like you, don't want to do a lot of work, start selecting some of those flowers that don't require deadheading.
So I like petunias. I just love petunias. And I don't like it that they're annuals because then every year I have to replant, you know. So I've been doing that then. Has the, you know, the flower dies, I pull it off so a new one can grow. Mm-hmm. So I've been deadheading and I didn't even know it.
Well, you have to understand, yeah, you have been deadheading and didn't know it. A lot of these are annuals simply because it gets too cold up here. And mm-hmm. some of their native habitats are perennials.
Oh.
So now, of course, they're not what they were when they found them in their native habitat, because a lot of breeding has made them, mm-hmm. you know, big flowers and they spread and those types of things. But many plants you can bring in and keep them growing and flowering all winter long.
So you take them in the house and...
Yeah, you can take them in the house.
Which ones would you suggest?
Whatever you like. As long as you get it in there before you get a frost, you can keep a lot of these things growing. Like geraniums, for instance, is an example. And people can propagate geraniums and come back with 100 more by spring. But the one thing you want to be sure of, whatever you plan on bringing in, you need to check it for pests mm-hmm. and treat it, because inside they have no predators and it's perfect temperature for reproduction and they just go crazy if you don't treat the pests.
Okay. All right. Well, what else? We're going to run out of time here shortly. Is there anything else we should talk about in August?
Well, August is never too early to start thinking about next year.
It's endless.
And what you should do is, well, a gardener thinks that's good. you should evaluate what you have and determine which things worked well in your garden and which ones didn't, and start making notes for the next year.
And taking pictures.
That's right. Also, you can start ordering seeds ahead of time if you want to get to it really early. Also, in the fall, we're starting to... get things ready for the winter. For instance, you're starting to prune your roses back. We didn't even talk about pruning roses. You need to keep all the dead flowers off so they'll continue to produce. Usually you get your biggest flush in June, and if you prune them properly, you get another flush about August. Mm-hmm. And don't do any fertilizing in August of anything except your lawn.
Okay.
Flowers and fruits and things should not be fertilized in, because actually, it's bad for the plants because they'll be delayed in getting ready for the cold weather that'll be coming up, and it actually can be damaging.
Okay, well, we'll come back in September, and so then we'll talk about maybe more of this stuff, mm-hmm. because we definitely in September want to think about putting the garden to bed, right?
That's
for the winter. Okay, folks, well, you've been listening to Strong Tower Radio today with Gary Heilig, our garden guy. And Tom and I enjoy this program, Tom especially, because he's really a garden enthusiast now. Have a great day, folks.
Bye now.